Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents From Conquest to Colony, Empire, Wealth, and Difference in 18th Century Brazil by Kirsten Schultz. Narrated by Alex Picard. Introduction. For both distant observers and the men who blazed the trails from Brazil's Atlantic coast into the hinterland in search of natives to enslave, the discovery of gold in the mountainous and riverine region north of Rio de Janeiro at the end of the 17th century was at once foreseen and fortuitous. "It was always well known," wrote the Italian Jesuit André João Antonil around the turn of the 18th century, "that in Brazil there were iron, gold, and silver mines, but there was always considerable inattention to discovering and exploiting them as well. Indeed, while traces of mineral deposits, including gold found in the captaincy of São Vicente in the 16th century, had conjured up visions of a new Potosí, visions pursued into the next century by itinerant and often clandestine prospectors, a significant mining enterprise eluded the Portuguese in the first centuries of conquest and settlement. Perhaps, Antonil speculated, settlers had been too comfortable living off the fruits of fertile lands and streams to invest in exploring Brazil's bowels. Or perhaps, a bent for hunting Indians in the forests distracted them from this less indecent and more useful enterprise. In any case, the dribs and drabs of alluvial ore that made their way to royal smelting houses did not inspire dissemination of the practical knowledge needed for future success in prospecting. Even men with experience in the hinterland could not tell the difference between treasure and the earth's less valuable elements. Slave raiders regularly mistook tourmalines for emeralds, and, Antonil recounted, the mulatto, who was said to have been the first discoverer of the most substantial deposits of Brazilian gold, did not know that the steel-colored pebbles that he scooped out of a stream while with some settlers to look for Indians were of the most precious metal of all. Nor did his companions to whom he showed the stones know how to recognize and esteem what he had so easily found, Antonil added. The confusion continued in the village of Daubaté as the mulatto and his companions sold the ore for a modest sum, without knowing what they sold and without the buyer knowing what he bought. Only later, when the stones ended up before the governor in Rio de Janeiro, Arthur de Sá, and after they had been more carefully examined, were they recognized to be the finest gold. The gold was not only the finest, it was also copious. Other discoveries, mostly along the Espinhaço Mountains, quickly followed. Prospectors from São Paulo, northeastern Brazil, and Portugal flooded into the region. Some starved, and some struck it rich. Wealth generated from the extracted ore began to flow not only to miners, but also to smugglers, goldsmiths, slave traders, merchants, and royal coffers. If Brazil had been the monarchy's milch cow, as King João IV, reigned 1640 to 1656, had described it years earlier to the French minister in Portugal, these sizable and unexpected discoveries made American territory even more of a prize. Yet, as royal officials in Portugal and Brazil celebrated what seemed like a providential turn of events, especially when viewed alongside the decline of Portuguese commercial networks in Asia, they also recognized that the discoveries raised intricate and pressing questions. How would the Portuguese administer and exploit the new American treasure? How would the Portuguese crown defend a resurgent American empire in an Atlantic world of rivals? How would the crown govern and forge civil, political, and economic order in a distant territory and across a dynamic socio-economic geography that encompassed indigenous peoples, Africans, and Europeans, the free and the enslaved, the wealthy and the poor? This book examines how royal officials and vassals of the Portuguese monarchy on both sides of the Atlantic understood and reckoned with these transformations and questions, and how, in the process, they redefined the status of Brazil within the empire. Portugal's sovereignty in America, as royal officials, chroniclers, and settlers affirmed, had been forged in conquests and evangelizations that incorporated new lands and peoples into the monarchy. While the political-cultural legacies of conquest endured, especially as they had been cultivated among settlers, royal officials came to argue that the discovery of gold and subsequent hinterland settlement demanded new approaches to governance and administration. Ensuring that the wealth produced in Brazil flowed into imperial networks of exchange depended not only on the allegiance of European and Europeanized settlers living far from their king, but also on a regulation of socio-economic relations defined by legal status, ancestry, labor, and wealth that differentiated Portuguese America from Portugal. Reinvigorating Portugal's imperial and commercial power, in other words, meant understanding and defending what made Brazil a colony. Conquests and colonies. While references to Brasil Colonia are recurrent in modern histories of Brazil, it was only in the 18th century, as historian Rodrigo Bens Monteiro observes in his study of the Portuguese monarchy, that royal officials began to refer primarily and consistently to the crown's American territory as a colony. Before then, the Portuguese crown's sovereignty comprised conquests and states, as well as commerce and navigated waterways. João V, reign 1706 to 1750, was, by the grace of God, King of Portugal and of the Algarves, of below and beyond the sea in Africa, Lord of Guinea and of the conquest, navigation, and commerce of Ethiopia, Arabia, Persia, and India, etc. Such a manifold title was but one reflection of an imperial monarchy's complex and changing constitutional dimensions and the political and administrative discontinuities that attended them. In the wake of military incursions into North Africa, the so-called papal donation, and treaties with the Catholic kings of neighboring Spain, lands claimed in eastern South America in the 16th century had become one of several ultramarine conquests, places where the Portuguese had negotiated with and warred against coastal indigenous peoples to establish enclaves of Portuguese authority. As settlement proceeded, along with references to the conquests, chroniclers and officials traded in diverse and often indefinite terms to designate the monarchy's new American territory. Writing in the 1570s within a broader debate about the religious and commercial motives for claiming lands beyond Europe, the chronicler Pero de Malgalhães Gandavo invoked the discoverer Pedro Álvares Cabral's naming ceremony in May 1500, as well as Portuguese dedication to the Order of Christ, to defend reference to the province of the Holy Cross against the more vulgar land of Brazil, so called after the dyewood extracted from the forests of indigenous coastal lands. At stake, he explained, was a diabolical effort to eradicate the memory of the sacred origins of Portugal's presence in the New World. Royal administrative schemes added to this emerging patchwork of terms used to describe the crown's American claims with an imperial nomenclature. In the 1530s, the crown divided the coast and its hinterland into numerous hereditary parcels, which royally appointed donatary captains were expected to defend, settle, and exploit. In the wake of this arrangement's notoriously limited success, in 1548, the crown sent Tomé de Souza as governor of all the captaincies and settlements in the lands of Brazil, intending, as Pedro Puntoni has explained, that his authority would prevail over, but not entirely annul, that of the donatory captains. The first governor, together with the royal treasurer and the magistrate who joined him, were to constitute a new administrative structure for incorporating all of Portuguese America into the monarchy. Following the restoration of Portuguese sovereignty from Spanish Habsburg rule, 1580 to 1640, in 1645, the new Braganza, King João IV, also appealed to the image of American territorial unity when he decreed that the heir to the throne would be known as Prince of Brazil. Yet even though this innovation, as Maria de Fátima Silva Gouveia observed, invoked values and notions of governability and vassalage that distinguished Brazil from other parts of the empire, it did not entail the creation of a principality in administrative terms. As the royal charter made clear, Brazil would be possessed in title only. References to American territory as a whole were also mitigated by the creation of new administrative frameworks. In 1621, territory in the north was reconfigured as the state of Maranhão, apart from remaining territories of the state of Brazil, while the various 17th-century iterations of a Repartição do Sul, southern district, proved more short-lived. They too reinforced the institutional pluralities through which the crown sought to exercise sovereignty. In practice, as Pedro Carjim and Susana Munch Miranda conclude, the crown's administrative approach made Portuguese America an archipelago of settlements, a situation that favored the jurisdictional autonomy of the various poles of which it was comprised. Within this dynamic imperial lexicon, and alongside pluralistic administrative practice, official and literary references to Brazil as one of several conquests scattered across the globe suggested continuities from east to west within the Portuguese monarchy's extra-European lands. In 1736, as the Gazeta de Lisboa reported, the portfolio of a new Minister of the Navy and Conquests included nominations for Viceroys, Governors, and Captains General of the States of India, Brazil, Maranhão, the Kingdom of Angola, Islands of Madeira, Açores, Cape Verde, and Fortresses of Africa. As our conquests had come to encompass an array of political administrative categories across the monarchy, the notion of conquest itself also expanded. Already in the fledgling African enterprise, the Portuguese recognized that conquest could proceed from both war and what Afonso V, reign 1438 to 1481, described as friendly relations and arrangements. Consequently, the conquests included any lands where the Portuguese had secured a presence, not just those occupied in the wake of military victories. The conquerors, therefore, were men who had taken any of the first steps, whether bellicose or diplomatic, toward the consolidation of diverse Portuguese claims to trade and settle. In America, as Sebastioa da Rocha Pita reminded readers of his Historia da América Portuguesa, 1730, this path to securing sovereignty had been circuitous. The king Dom João III, he reported of his native Bahia, gave it to Francisco Pereira Coutinho, who was the first who came to settle after Diogo Álvares Correia, who dwelt there, and Cristóvão Jaques, who discovered it. Francisco Pereira Coutinho, who had arrived from India with great wealth and resources, and had secured royal favor, forearmed a squadron of ships, in which, accompanied by noble people for settlement and by soldiers for defense, he came to conquer the land. Discovering, dwelling, conquering. Through these intertwined rather than discrete and linear acts, the Portuguese had forged indigenous American land into the conquest of Brazil. As officials and chroniclers recognized the multifaceted actions through which a distant extra-European territory had been incorporated into the monarchy, in practice, the ideal of conquest came to frame American appeals into a shared juridical political culture, whether to overturn an inferior status relative to other territories in the monarchy acquired through inheritance or pact, to transcend geographical distance, or to seek royal grace. Conquerors, settlers, and traders could point to their service in the occupation of American land as a basis for their own authority on the ground and their status before a king with vassals across the globe. The crisis of the 17th century, especially the Dutch occupation of northeastern Brazil and the local fight to restore Portuguese sovereignty there, then afforded new opportunities to assert this status against both conquered peoples and renderings of the residents of American territory as unvaryingly and nobly dominated by remote European power. "We are not conquered vassals," members of Salvador's town council informed the king in 1688. Their loyalty and obedience, and the resources they had expended to defend Brazil against the monarchy's rivals, commended them to recognition as vassals no different from those in the Kingdom of Portugal itself. After all, since 1653, the city of Salvador da Bahia had enjoyed the right to dispatch envoys to meetings of the representative and consultative Portuguese Cortes. Yet, as officials, chroniclers, and settlers thus recognized Brazil as one of many conquests forged in war and trade, and thereby incorporated into a pluricontinental monarchy, political practice also distinguished Portuguese America from other extra-European territories. What historians have described as an incentive system of military service and rewards, conspicuous in the insignia of military orders and commanderies, privileged tours of duty in Asia and especially in Africa, in wars against infidel enemies, and, conversely, excluded recognition of actions taken during the initial occupation of the Brazilian coast. Throughout the 16th century, Asia and the defense of Portuguese commercial outposts continued to draw nobility into royal service. The crown, in turn, reinforced that enterprise's prestige, creating the office of the viceroy with broad authority to act locally within the state of India in the name of the king. In Brazil, in contrast, expeditions to punish and enslave natives who resisted Portuguese settlement did not offer the same promise of distinction, and the crown did not invest in the institutionalization of royal authority and justice to the same degree. As historians have noted, a century passed between the founding of a high court, Redenção, in Goa, 1544, and its counterpart in Bahia, 1609-1652. While throughout the 17th century, the highest-ranking representative in Portuguese America remained a governor-general. The Portuguese monarchy's 18th-century Atlantic turn, already evident in late 17th-century undertakings to claim territory in Rio de la Plata, and consolidated by the discovery of vast deposits of gold, renewed scrutiny of American administration and Brazil's status within the empire. The flow of gold from the Brazilian hinterland and the commerce that the new enterprise sustained suggested to royal officials that America would compensate for what had been lost in Asia to European rivals and local rulers and would serve to renovate the empire as a whole. At the same time, in the first decades of the 18th century, the initially more lucrative and glorious Asian venture remained a standard that Brazil had not yet met. Although the crown began to refer to men appointed to govern Brazil as viceroys, the new designation was associated with a previous posting of highest rank in India, rather than with a new administrative status for American territory. In Lisbon, officials also defended limits of the powers of the crown's representative in Brazil. In 1714, advising against giving the viceroy of Brazil the power to grant honorific privileges and membership in military orders, the Overseas Council, Conselho Ultramarino, explained that if the Viceroy of India enjoyed his authority, it was to encourage the noblemen of this kingdom to go to that state, so that in wars there they strive to achieve singular and heroic actions. The governance of India is totally military and bellicose, the counselors observed, and the viceroys are always in campaign, either at sea or on land, contending with the kings of Asia and even many times with European nations, which is not the case in Brazil. The juxtaposition of a military enterprise in Asia and its absence in America elided the history of expeditions in the previous century, deployed to end Dutch occupations in Pernambuco and Bahia, to thwart French plans for settlements in Maranhão, and to expand Portuguese sovereignty in Rio de la Plata. The council did recognize, however, that the War of Spanish Succession, 1701 to 1714, energized imperial rivalries, and more specifically foreign designs on Brazil's minds, and therefore demanded investment in the martial means of securing and defending Portuguese-American sovereignty. To begin with, Royal counselor Antonio Rodriguez da Costa advised in 1709 the defense of Rio de Janeiro, serving as a port for the mining region, required investments even beyond the council's recent provisions for new fortification and an infantry regiment in the city. In fact, within months, his concerns materialized in clear and vivid form. In 1710, the French corsair Jean-François de Clercq launched an attack on Rio de Janeiro, but was rebuffed by local forces. No one escaped except a fugitive black who had served as a guide, one pamphlet reported of the Lusophone forces' triumph. By February 1712, however, letters reached Lisbon with news of a second successful French assault and occupation of the city in 1711, which ended only after officials in Rio offered a ransom and return to the French prisoners of war taken the previous year. Reckoning with the French attacks, officials worried about lasting and damaging effects for both Brazil and the Kingdom of Portugal. In response, the crown punished the actions of officials in Rio, stepped up investments in the city's fortification, and issued orders that mandated stricter supervision of foreign vessels in Brazilian ports. Defending American sovereignty, counselors warned, also required addressing broader problems of governance and allegiance. In Pernambuco in the 1710s, the crown faced armed challenges to its authority rooted in the social order of settlement and the willingness of a local nobility to defend its status against upstart merchants. Such a development was especially alarming, Rodriguez da Costa warned, considering French ambition in America and the possibility that those vassals would embrace the protection of the King of France. In the mining region, in turn, threats to sovereignty came not only from the possibility that vassals would turn to foreign rulers, but also from a rootlessness that seemed to defy the consolidation of political order itself. The king, Rodriguez da Costa observed, could not rule over people without law, order, and obedience, without fear of magistrates and punishment, without hope of a reward. In the first decades of the 18th century, the crown sought to address these challenges, achieve fiscal control, and thwart adventurers, interlopers, and rebels by investing in administrative personnel and by redefining the jurisdictions in which officials served. Then, and again in the 1750s, the crown moved to formally incorporate the remaining donatary captaincies into the state of Brazil. During João V's reign, Portugal's American sovereignty was cultivated as well, in symbolic and spectacular displays of royal power of unprecedented scale. Brazilian rituals of the royal life cycle grew more frequent and more lavish, especially in the mining region, where religious festivals and local rites of political obeisance became organizing elements of society. An America settled in order to extract wealth, Rodrigo Montero has posited, became the mirror that reflected, in multiple ways, the authority of the Portuguese king in Portugal and beyond. Fittingly, in Brazil, João V's funerary rites, the first to be celebrated across the empire, included especially luxuriant displays of local elites' productive and consumptive capacities, reminders of the wealth and power that had defined his rule, their American sources, and his American vassals' allegiance. Like local invocations of service to the crown, the commemorations of the king's life and death and the descriptive accounts subsequently issued inscribed Portuguese settlements in Brazil into a larger pluricontinental community of vassals defined by royal authority and tradition. These same celebrations and written accounts, however, could also make known the differences that the 18th century monarchy had come to contain. Writing on behalf of the Holy Office of the Inquisition in 1709, one censor determined that Rocha Pita's account of the Bahian funerary commemorations for Pedro II, reign 1668 to 1706, was out of date. In Lisbon, even the beginning of the reign of João V had already assuaged his subjects' grief. As a result, only recalling the distance that separated Lisbon and the City of Bahia, metropolis of Portuguese America, and the difference that distance produced made the account intelligible. Years later, writing of João V's Bahian funerary honors, one panegyrist similarly reminded readers that the king had ruled over communities and sites of production that were distinguished by geography and history, not only from each other, but, above all, from those in Europe. The king's glorious reign, the panegyrist concluded, had been a time when commerce flourished free of danger, both within the kingdom and its colonies. The reference to extra-European territories as colonies may have called to mind what the Theatine father Raphael Bluteau had summarized just a few decades earlier as a convergence of people, action, and space. A colony, Bluteau explained in his authoritative Vocabulario Portugués e Latino, 1712 to 1728, was the people who are sent to some newly discovered or conquered land to settle it, pouvoir, added that the land so settled is also called that. This process of demographic diffusion, chroniclers and royal officials recognized, had defined Iberia itself and remained manifest in cities that had begun as Roman colonies. As the crown extended its sovereignty beyond Europe, ancient configurations had reemerged. The paths to conquest, the 16th century chronicler João de Barros reported, included sending vassals and natives to live in acquired lands, the kind of settlements the Romans called colonies. A century and a half later, one Portuguese pamphleteer observed the similarly interconnected trajectory of settlement and conflict in the more recent past. The Portuguese arrived at that coast, José Freire Monteroyo Mascanheiras wrote of eastern South America. Their colonies grew prolifically, and enlarging their conquests, they overcame the Tupinamba, the Tupineus, and the Tupuyas. Thus, across a now global empire, colonies were communities of ultramarine vassals, forged as the Portuguese had conquered, displaced, traded with, and Christianized native peoples in allegiance to the crown. By the time João V's panegyrist looked back on his reign in the colonies, however, contemporary understandings of colonies had also expanded beyond Bluteau's recapitulation of ancient legacies and acts of conquest, migration, and settlement, to include the delineation and defense of distinct social and economic functions within European empires. As Anthony Pagden has observed for Spain, Britain, and France, renewed debates about the sources of wealth and power, based on an ensemble of ideas about money, commerce, population, and the state, later denominated mercantilism, displaced an older defense of universal projects to Christianize, as well as attendant preoccupations with honor and the spirit of conquest. The administration of empire and, above all, of the imperial commercial economy became a calculation of benefits intended to privilege metropolitan interests defined as such. Among Portuguese royal officials and vassals, too, the much-debated economic dimensions of the 18th-century empire became paramount, and Brazil's colonial status was identified with limits on commerce and other productive activities imposed by metropolitan power. American resources, Brazilian-born royal counselor Alexandre de Guzmão argued plainly in 1749, were to yield European rather than American wealth. Raw materials should be extracted from colonies to be manufactured in the capital, the polymath Antonio Ribeiro Sanchez explained in a mid-18th century treatise on Portuguese America. And all the foodstuffs that do not grow in the capital should be planted in the colonies, he further clarified, as well as those that grow in the primary state with difficulty or those that are bought abroad. As a colony, in other words, Portuguese America encompassed socio-economic communities intended to complement and support, rather than reproduce metropolitan ways of producing and consuming wealth. Consequently, governance and administration entailed defining how Brazil's various enterprises, plantations, mines, and markets, were both fundamentally different from the European polity and society that forged them, and integrated into networks of exchange defined by European authority and prosperity. Such an understanding of the relationship between Portugal and its American territory.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?